Well, hello everybody, and welcome to Astrology Hub's Cosmic Connection. This is the place where we explore the beauty and order of the cosmos and your connection to it all. My name's Amanda Poole Walsh. I'm the founder of Astrology Hub, and I am here with Rick Merlin Levine. And what do you want to say to them just to start it off?
I'm always happy to be here because we seem to just create an environment that allows interesting things to flow forth. And I'm happy to be the rent-a-mouth. I mean, it's not my stuff that flows forth. I'm just here making my mouth open and close, and somehow the stuff is arriving and leaving. And so I'm happy to play. This is fun.
Rent a mouth. Oh, that's just classic.
Actually, I have to be honest. I actually heard that line from my solar astro twin Ram Dass many years ago, who said, "You're all here to hear me. I'm just here to sit on stage for a few hours. It's like you've all come into my living room, and I'm not saying anything you don't know. I'm just the rent-a-mouth." So it's his line.
Oh, it's so great.
It's a
It's
good
so
line.
good. All right, so today we are talking about astrology as sacred geometry. So, what does that mean, Rick?
I don't know
Yeah, I mean,
yet.
basically, where do we start with that?
Well, I think we have to start with geometry. And maybe we have to start with two separate words, because we like to break things down, or I do. And that is geometry and sacred. And when you break things down, that's really what analysis is. Analysis, of which Virgo is the king or queen of analysis, that's breaking things apart into little pieces. The other side of that, Virgo, is the opposite side, Pisces, which is synthesis, which is bringing things back together. And in astrology, we, in order to be a decent astrologer and to make sense out of patterns and or charts, we really have to be able to do both. We have to be able to first do the analysis and separate things into their separate threads, and then we have to do the synthesis and put it all back together into a single meaning. So let's do the analysis on sacred geometry. And I think sacred is relatively easy. I always think of Mircea Eliade's book, The Sacred and the Profane. There's basically two ways of looking at the universe. And to the ancients, the sacred was everything in the divine proportion, and the profane was everything in the earthly proportion. And when I say divine proportion and earthly proportion, I'm really kind of using concepts that are the basis of Catholicism, where there is the heaven and hell realms, which are in the divine proportion, the cosmic realms, if you will. And then here on earth, we are, but we here on earth have fallen through the gate of Saturn. We've talked about that in other conversations. And while we're on earth, we are not sacred. We are profane. This is the origin of the concept of original sin. It's the origin of the concept of, the division between being a human and being a god, which is very offensive to some people. But then there is a whole generation of, I don't want to call it new age thinking, but there is a word around it, where we all aspire to the godliness within us, which is really aspiring toward the sacred. So the word sacred, in sacred geometry, is not the geometry of measuring sticks to build a house. That would kind of be profane, if you will, because it's of the earthly proportion. Sacred is the geometry that is of divinity. So that's the sacred piece. Geometry is interesting because it really means measuring the earth. Geo is earth, like geocentric, or geography, that's earth. and anything with the meter at the end, meter or metric, is basically about measuring. So really, a geometer is someone who measures Earth, and it's for laying out either cities or streets or buildings. I mean, there's nothing sacred about geometry because it's measuring Earth until you do it in relationship with something that is not earthly. Then geometry becomes sacred. And this is really where we come into astrology, because it's almost, although we came up with the title today, Astrology as Sacred Geometry, it might actually be a typo. It might be astrology is sacred geometry. We could change the A in as to an I and go astrology is sacred geometry, period. Even becomes a sentence. And it's sacred geometry because it has to do with measuring. Geometry, actually, even though it means measuring the earth, has really come to be the mathematics around the relationship between spatial objects. So that geometry, we study points and lines and triangles and quadrilaterals and, you know, and Pythagoras's a squared plus b squared equals c squared, the law of the right triangle, which gave us the ability to measure something small and then by proportion measure it large, so we could actually figure out distances on Earth and so on, all by proportion. This is all geometry. Geometry has to do with spatial mathematics. Someone asked me recently, I don't understand what you mean by sacred geometry. And I said, well, do you know what geometry is? Did you take it? Most people in an academic track, not everyone, you know, took a year or a semester of geometry in high school for people of my generation. Most of us took it, I think, in 10th grade, you know, first or second year of high school. We took a year of geometry, where we learned all about what parallel lines were and how to prove that lines were parallel or that two triangles were similar, even if they were different size, they were congruent. That's all geometry. So the difference between that and sacred geometry is the it's basically, I had a metaphor, but it's basically the difference between it's basically the difference between astronomy and astrology. You know, astronomy is the looking at the things and giving them names and understanding their movement and that kind of stuff. And astrology adds a sacredness to it by giving it meaning. And sacred geometry gives the spatial relationships to things meaning. And so we have, for example, we have a history in the Western tradition that has to do with the secret initiate order of people who were trained to build sacred structures. What I mean by sacred structures, I mean, you know, the churches, the cathedrals. You could not build one of these. You didn't go to a town and go, let's see, who knows how to work with rocks? Joe, he lives on the end of town. Well, bring Joe over. We're building a new church. You know, we're building a temple, a cathedral here. And so we'll get Joe to build it. No, Joe couldn't build the temple because the only people that were allowed to build temples were people who were initiated into the sacredness of the geometry. And those people were in a working order, and they were called the stonemasons, which is, of course, the origin of the modern masons. You know, masons were people who worked with stone, but they weren't just working with stone. There was a sacred side to what they were doing that they were not allowed to tell people who were not initiated in this whole order of understanding the sacredness, people were allowed to go into a church or a cathedral or a temple and feel, wow, there's something special about this. But they weren't allowed to understand what the mathematics were and why certain places feel special and certain places don't. This is sacred geometry. One of the basic underlying pieces of all sacred geometry has to do with pattern. It has to do with shape. Actually, I said one, several. Pattern, shape, and proportion. And the first thing I want to focus on, just to talking about sacred geometry, is about proportion. Because there was a proportion that the stonemasons learned about that the common person knew nothing about. I say the common person, the uninitiated person. And one of the secrets of being a stonemason was understanding this proportion that the ancients referred to as the divine proportion. People may have heard that word, the divine proportion. Somewhere in the late Middle Ages, it became renamed and it was called the golden ratio or the golden mean. It's the same thing. But this divine proportion is a very, very particular ratio that is at the basis of all sacred geometry. In fact, this is a mathematics that is at the basis of all life, of all crystalline structures, of all planetary movement. And until you know about it, you don't know about it. I know that sounds stupid, but there's a point here because two people can look at the same tree and one person who has been initiated into the secrets of the magic of trees might see a very different tree than the other person sees. And these teachings that are called secret teachings are actually referred to as hermetic teachings. This is the word, and it comes from Hermes, which is Greek for Mercury, which is Latin for Thoth, who was the Egyptian version of Hermes and Mercury, who was the keeper of the truth, the giver of the truth. And in fact, the Greek version of that, there was a character in Egypt that it's a mythological character. We don't know. I don't think anyone has any birth records of this person, called Hermes Trismegistus. And Hermes Trismegistus really is Hermes, the thrice great magician, thrice tris, tri, Hermes tri-magical, if you will. Hermes Trismegistus. Magi was simply a magician, someone who was an initiate into these secret traditions, secret teachings. Here's the interesting thing, bringing this up to current times. What does it mean when something is hermetically sealed? What comes to mind? You know, you get this box, it's been hermetically sealed. Your hard drive is hermetically sealed. What does it mean?
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't know.
Wait. Is there?
Well, sometimes you ask a question, but then you answer it. So I wasn't sure if this was really a question for me.
Yeah, I'm not trying to put you on the spot.
That you can't crack the code?
Thank you. Exactly. And I was hesitant because I really wasn't trying to put you on the spot in case you didn't know. But if something's hermetically sealed, you don't know how to get in.
Yeah.
You know, someone can get into something that's hermetically sealed, but only if you know the secret teaching. Hmm. So this is Hermes, the trickster who shows a normal tree to a person who doesn't know that there's an entire universe of secret teachings within it. One of the early initiate orders was an order that was called the Order of the Golden Apple, and it was the Order of Pythagoras. We're back to Pythagoras, who was one of the great early geometers who practiced sacred geometry. Now, the story is that that Pythagoras, I believe, was a vegetarian, was nonviolent, was there was a commitment in joining the order, and there was like secret teachings that you had to earn the right, you know, in process to get to the next level of teaching. And when a Pythagorean, a member of this secret order of the Golden Apple, when they traveled, they would find themselves staying at an inn, and they would sit down at a table at the inn, and they would get an apple. The apples then were golden in color. And they would take an apple, and they would slice it in half horizontally. You ever done that?
Yes.
Do you know what appears when you slice an apple horizontally?
A star.
A five-pointed star, because the seeds in an apple, like many sacredly geometrically composed figures in nature, are regular, I use the word regular in the Platonic sense, a regular pattern. Regular meaning that they're all the sides. So so a four-sided figure or four-sided polygon that's regular is a square, meaning that all sides are the same. A three-sided figure that is a regular three-sided figure is an equilateral triangle that in astrology, we call that a grand trine. We call a regular square a grand square. It's just geometry. A five-pointed star is a regular pentagram or pentagon, which has its own sacredness that we'll come back to in a moment. But the thing is, that as we know in astrology, action occurs on the divisions of a circle by four, meaning the conjunction, the square, the opposition, the square. Every 90 degrees of going around four times, you get to a point that creates the cardinal points, the four points, the ascendant, descendant, the midheaven, and the imium coli or imium celli, the point opposite the midheaven. These four points are the four points of the compass, north, south, east, west. These four points are the four points of the cross of Christianity that represents the material universe. The 90 degree angle is the angle of the material universe. Things come into being on 90 degreeness. And when I say 90 degreeness, I really mean 90, 180, 270, which is the square, you know, the other side, and back to zero, but also on half of that and half of that and half of that. It's like an ongoing kind of fractal-like thing. We know through astrology, which is based upon 12-folded regular geometry, that there's a duodecimal sense to astrology, a 12-pointed star that creates the horoscope wheel, if you will. But the five doesn't appear in astrology because the fivefold geometry is not physical. It's not material. The physical material geometry is the geometry of dividing a cycle or a rhythm or a hum or a circle in half or in thirds, or in half again, that makes a quarter, or half of a third is a sixth, and so on and so on and so on. But five in geometry, the division by five doesn't, you can't create structure. It falls through the cracks. However, when you take an apple and you slice it horizontally, you end up seeing this five-pointed star. And the five-pointed star was the geometrical representation of the teachings that were not obvious. They were the hidden teachings. And so if you were a member of the Order of the Golden Apple, the secret initiate order of Pythagoras, you would go into a tavern and you would get an apple you would slice it in half and you would set half of it on the table. You'd eat the other half, you'd eat your dinner, you'd have your beer or your wine or whatever it was that they were serving, because as we know, you know, until the 1800s or so, no one drank water because it was poisonous. You drank water or beer, something with alcohol in it that would kill things that otherwise you drank water, chances are you would die. So, you would be sitting at your table and someone else would come along and sit down at the table and they would take an apple and slice it in half and put half of it on the table face up. And you immediately knew that you could talk to this person about those things that you didn't talk to people about because they were muggles. So that even Pythagoras had this system for identifying who the wizards were, who the sorcerers were, who the initiates were, versus the muggles who just saw a tree, who saw something that was hermetically sealed and said, can't get in there, don't bother, can't get in there. And meanwhile, Hermes was teaching how to get into the secrets. And the hermetic teachings, or the hermetic philosophy, is the philosophy of all those things which are not on the surface. They're not apparent. You don't know about them until you know about them, and then you know about them. And I know that sounds stupid, but there's so many things that we don't know, because we don't know about them. And then when we know about them, all of a sudden it's, oh my God, you know, there's something to astrology, for example. How many people think that they know that there's nothing to astrology because they've never been shown how to get into the hermetically sealed body of knowledge that is kept from the public, even though it's out there all the time and in their faces, they can't see it. Are you with me here?
Yes. Okay, so we're still on
sacred geometry.
We're on proportion. So you said there's pattern, shape, and proportion.
Well, we're on where shape and proportion come together, which is where we're okay. going with this. But right. Yes, we're on proportion, because there is a proportion that Pythagoras was totally into proportions. In fact, the A squared plus B squared equals C squared is basically about making proportions in a triangle and being able to know one side of a triangle and figure out all the other sides of the triangle, because you know that there's a 90 degree angle and that A squared plus B squared always equals C squared. The other proportion, though, that was of great use, aside from what we call the law of the right triangle or the Pythagorean theorem, that's the A squared plus B squared equals C squared, is the law that determined the divine proportion. And the divine proportion, Johannes Kepler, my guy, Johannes Kepler, who when people say, oh, you're an astrologer, who are your teachers? What lineage? I go, well, I'm an astrologer in the lineage of Pythagoras and Kepler. Ah, clue as to why we're having this conversation. Kepler said that there were two great jewels. No, he used the word gems. There were two priceless gems, he said, in mathematics. One gem in geometry, I think is what he said. One gem was Pythagoras's law of the right triangle. He said that was like a diamond. He said, but the law of the mean and the extreme is an emerald. What the hell is the law of the mean and the extreme? Well, the law of the mean and the extreme creates the divine proportion, which it's obvious that Pythagoras knew about. Why? Because there's only one way to geometrically create this exact ratio, because this ratio is one of these numbers like pi. It's not pi, but pi is one of these numbers that goes on forever. You know, it you could write what pi is, you know, on your blackboard or on a wall, and you'd keep adding numbers and you'd go out the window and you'd go down the landscape and over the hills and through the woods and far away, and you still would never get to the exact number because there's no way to express it. Well, the divine proportion is the same. You cannot express it in actual numbers. But like pi, you can express pi by just drawing a circle and making a radius. You know, if you have a circle with a center and you draw a line from the center of the circle to the circumference, to the outer part of the circle, that line divided into the length of the circumference, that's what pi is. And every time we draw a circle, we're using that ratio. It's sacred geometry. We just don't even know it. All right. So there's a way in which we can create geometrically the number pi. Just draw a circle and create a radius. You know, take a piece of rope and go around the edge of the circle, pick another piece of rope that's the, you know, that's the radius of the circle, lay one against the other, and you see how many times it goes. That's what pi is. It turns out that there's a way to create the golden mean, and there's only one way to create it with a compass and a straight edge, which are the tools that ancient geometers had. They did not have, you know, Adobe Illustrator, where you could say, draw me a line 7.3158 inches long, and then give me another line that angles off of that by 31.4 degrees. There was no, I mean, we have those tools, but they did not. And so everything that they did had to be done with a straight edge, which is like a ruler with no markings on it, just a straight edge, and a compass. And a compass was simply a device where you had a center and something that would make a line that would go around it in a circle. And it turns out that you can make a five-pointed star with a compass and a straight edge. Google it. If I had a compass handy and I have one in my other office, I could show you in about six steps. It's easy to do. But Google it. Why? Because the five-pointed star is the only geometry that contains within it the divine proportion. What the hell is the divine proportion? Well, Kepler called it the law of the mean and the extreme. In mathematics, whenever you have a fraction or whenever you have ratios, there is a mean and an extreme. You say, this is to that, like that is to something else. That's a proportion, you know? If you're doing a recipe and you're trying to quadruple it, you know, you go one teaspoon is to four teaspoons, like a half a cup is to four, two cups. But you see, you have to make that proportion. Well, the proportion that you're getting to is the extreme, and the one that you're starting with is the mean. So the law of the mean and the extreme is this. There exists a ratio where this is to that by the same ratio that, I need you to look, this is to that by the same ratio that that is to something else that's even bigger. So in other words, it's the same ratio. It's like saying 2 is to 4, like 4 is to 8. 2 times 2 is 4. So 2 is to 4, like 4 is to 8, because you double it. Except the law of the mean and the extreme says this is to that, like that is to something else. However, the first two things added together equal that. Let me back that up again. It would be like saying 2 is to 4, like 4 is to 8, but 2 plus 4 doesn't equal 8, it equals 6. So you always have to have the first line plus the second line has to equal the third line. And then that same ratio to the fourth line means the two before it, you're always adding, but there's a proportion, a ratio, and an adding. Now, if this is complicated, it's going to be uncomplicated in just a moment. And why all this is important to astrology is like fascinating, but this is all like laying the groundwork. Anyone who has seen the movie or read the book, The Da Vinci Code, is going to have an understanding of the golden mean or the divine proportion, or they didn't see the movie, or they didn't read the book, or they read the book and saw the movie, but they didn't have the hermetic principle, and so they missed the whole meaning of the damn thing. Because the meaning of it had to do with the Da Vinci Code, and the idea was that the opening scene in the book, which occurs in front of the Mona Lisa in the Louvre, that the Mona Lisa was painted by Leonardo da Vinci, and the Mona Lisa was painted all to the ratios of this divine proportion. And it turns out that da Vinci actually was like a keeper of this secret initiate order, which is why the book and the movie was called the Da Vinci Code. And there's another character that enters the story now that is going to connect this for some people. And the name of this character is a guy who lived, I think he lived in the 13th century. I might be off 100 years here. I know that's awful but I think he lived in the 1200s. And his name, he was an Italian guy, and his name was Leonardo Fibonacci. People have probably heard of Leonardo Fibonacci because of what people call the Fibonacci numbers. Some people know what they are, and other people going, this is all way beyond me. I don't like mathematics and I hate that. And so I don't know what you're talking about. Well, Leonardo Fibonacci actually holds an important place in Western history, because until Leonardo Fibonacci, it was really illegal to be a Catholic and use Arabic numbers. In fact, it was punishable by death, because you were using the system of the infidels, the Arabs. And so Roman numerals were a major thing until Arabic numerals came into the scene. But Arabic numerals had something special that Roman numerals did not. And this is an important piece for understanding the culture in which we live and from which we came. And that is, in the Roman system and in the system of in the canon of Christianity, there is no languaging and no understanding of nothingness. Christianity is built upon the concept of this is the material world, because the profane has materiality and the sacred is not within the scope of our profane life living. And so from that standpoint, if you go back to Greek and or Roman numbers, there was no symbol for zero. In fact, to the Greeks, if you said three, if I say three to you, you understand the concept of threeness. To the ancients, three had no meaning unless there were three things. Do you understand the subtle difference? That to the ancients, numbers were the counting of things. Yeah. And you couldn't count zero because it was no thing. And along comes the Arabs using a Chinese invention. And the Chinese invention was this symbol for nothingness, the cipher. And basically, that is a very interesting story here, why in the 11 and 1200s, the Jewish merchants got the reputation for always outsmarting, out-Jewing the Catholic priests. And it's because they were ciphering. They were using zeros, and the Catholic priests were limited to using Roman numerals. You know, imagine getting a shipment of grain or cloth and trying to figure out the price, and someone saying, well, no, I think it should be, you know, 4.7 ducats. I don't even know what a ducat is, you know, rubles, pennies, whatever. And the other person saying, well, no, but if we do this at 4.1 rather than 4.0, and you're just doing this, the priest, which is the priests did the business of the church, they were multiplying and dividing using Roman numerals. You ever tried it? I have. It doesn't work very well. Meanwhile, because using the Arabic numbers was an act of infidelity, there were the infidels, the only people who were using the Arabic numbers were people who were already in trouble. And they were, but either the Arabs who were hiding their identity, or the Jews who were already in trouble. They were secretly in Spain in particular. You see, Spain was Arabic for about 700 years. And in the 1200s, when the Arabs were, when the Muslims, the Arabs, were kicked out of Spain, the Jews remained, but they became what were called Merinos. There was just a classification for Jews that were hidden Jews, because like the leftover Arabs, the Catholic Church was killing them if you were Jewish or Arabic, you know, or Muslim. And so these Jews had high positions in the various governments and so on. And partly because they were teaching in a hidden way, they were teaching their hidden tradition. And in fact, we're getting to the holiday time of year where we have Hanukkah, and the Jewish, at Hanukkah, Jewish kids play dreidel, which is this little game with Hebrew letters on the side. And it comes from this period of time where they would play this game as if it was a children's game, but they were actually teaching the children the Hebrew alphabet. And it was illegal to teach that. And so at the same time, they were teaching their kids how to do this incredible mathematics using zeros. It would be like today being in business and you belonging to a church that said, you're not allowed to use Excel or any form of computers, and everyone else is. How could you get the best of a business deal? Are you with me?
Yes.
All right. So this guy named Leonardo Fibonacci in the 1200s in Italy, I think he was in Pisa. I think he was in northwestern Italy somewhere. I'm not recalling off the top of my head. This was not a planned story today. I did not do any homework for this one.
Oh, like you usually do, huh?
All right, I never do. Okay, so Leonardo Fibonacci wrote a book called Acer Libris, and it meant the book of numbers. And in the book, which apparently he wrote in Italian, meaning that street people had access to it rather than it being in Latin, he basically wrote a book on how to use these strange Arabic numbers. And we would call this arithmetic. And in fact, his book, Acer Libris, was the first book on how to do arithmetic with Arabic numbers, including adding, subtracting, multiplying, and dividing. And in his book, he would have these problems he would pose, and then the solutions and how he used the numbers to get to the solutions. Well, one of the chapters in the book went something like this. It said, imagine a room with two rabbits in it. And without worrying about sex typing, without worrying about gender, assume that at the end of every month, because rabbits reproduce like rabbits, at the end of every month, that every pair of rabbits would begat another rabbit. And every month that went by, every pair of rabbits would produce another rabbit. How many rabbits would be in the room at the end of 3 months, 8 months, or 14 months? And the solution in that was actually led to what we call the Fibonacci number series, because it went like this. You had one rabbit, male, one rabbit, female. 1 + 1 = 2. You now have two rabbits in a room. 2 + 1 = 3. You'd have three rabbits at the end of 1 month. 3 + the number prior to it = 2 the month before. 3 + 2 = 5. You'd have 5 at the end of next month. 5 + 3, that was the number the month before. 5 + 3 = 8. 8 + 5 = 13. 13 + 8 = 21. 21 + 13 = 34, 55, 89, 144, and so on. And each number that you get to next, you get to by adding the two numbers prior. So that what, so that in the Fibonacci number series, 8 is there because 5 plus 3 equals 8. 13 is there because 8 plus 5 equals 13. 21 is there because 13 plus 8, am I doing this right? Yeah, equals 21. Well, when Fibonacci did this, I'm not sure that he understood. But what he realized is that as you go further and further along in this series of numbers, and you divide any number in that series by the number before, remember, we got to it by adding them. But if you divide any number by the number before it, you get closer and closer and closer and closer, slightly above, slightly below, closer, slightly above, closer, slightly below, to this magical number that the ancients knew as the divine proportion. So the Fibonacci number series are numbers, whole numbers, that are part of this divine proportion. We're going to cycle back to that in just a moment. But first, I want to just put on the table, because we haven't yet, what the hell is this number? We know that pi is 3.14 or 3.141, blah, blah, blah. So the divine proportion is about 1.62. So it's over 1.5, but it's less than 1¾. And so this number is actually 1.618. It's actually 1.618, 1.618033 9, and that's about as far as I can remember. It's a number that goes forever. You can't create the number mathematically. You have to round it off. You round it off to it's about 1 2/3, close. You know, it's 1.6. 1.6666 would be 1 2/3. It's about 1.62, so it's close. All right. It turns out that these Fibonacci numbers are the basis of almost everything animate in the world. For example, we're going to come back to the apple. 5, remember, that it's 1 plus 1 equals 2, 2 plus 1 equals 3, 3 plus 2 equals 5, 5 plus 3 equals 8. So the first numbers on the Fibonacci number series are 1, 2, 3, 5, and 8, which in the book, The Da Vinci Code, when they had that thing to solve the mystery, to open it up, and if they turned to the wrong numbers, then it would be dissolved and they would never get the clue. That was one of the clues. The breakthrough was the numbers must be Fibonacci numbers, because they create the secret, you know, magical number. And so they set it to 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, and it opened up and it did not dissolve. So we're tying this back to that concept. Okay. It turns out that this ratio is the ratio that occurs everywhere in nature. It's the mathematical definition of what is referred to as the spiral of Archimedes, which is this spiral that starts out small and then grows bigger very quickly. It's the spiral of a conch or conch, a conch shell. You know that, in fact, all seashells conform to the mathematics of the divine proportion, because it is the naturally occurring spiral. It is the mathematics of the spiraling arms of the Milky Way galaxy conform to this 1.62 or 1.618033 9 dot, 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 dot. It turns out that not all plants, but many plants have 5 petals. Lilies, interestingly, which are poisonous, have 6. You don't eat a lily. Mm. In fact, people who have cats protect their cats from lilies often. Mostly cats will not eat lilies. I mean, but they're poisonous. A rose, however, has 5 points. and rose flavored jams and perfumes and things that, I mean, roses is healthy. Borage is 5 points. I mean, there's a lot of 5-pointed plants. But here's the crazy thing, and that is that all daisies and daisy family plants, including chrysanthemums and black-eyed Susans and all the various daisies, they all naturally occur with the number of petals that are Fibonacci numbers. You can find, and unfortunately, I'm nerdy enough that I can't tell you how many over 40, 50 years of my life, how many times when someone else was going, she loves you not, I'm going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 55. most daisies have either 55 or 34 petals. You'll find them occasionally with 56 or with, you know, whether they are missing one. But when you look at a picture of a bud, you can actually, in the bud itself, before it opens up, you can see the ridges and you can count them, and and you'll see 13. I mean, and 13 doesn't occur astrologically, nor does 5. But this is part of the hidden piece of the sacred geometry of astrology, which we're going to come back to in full circle. I just need to make sure that we understand that crystals, life in general, unfolds to the magic of geometry. Bucky Fuller, who was one of the great geometers of the 20th century, who invented the geodesic dome, which allegedly hangs on the U.S. Patent Office wall as a as an example of the perfect patent. He patented it, but it was a form of how nature actually geometrically contains itself. How does a cloud made of water weighing hundreds of thousands of tons suspend itself in the air? Sacred geometry. How does a tree weighing many tons, these big trees, just kind of somehow spread the energy out so it seems weightless, and the energy is all, and of course the Buckminster Fuller term is tensegrity, which is a balance between tension and compression, which is important in astrology, but we only get there when we talk about aspects, which we talked about a bit in the fundamentals course, and we'll certainly dig in more in the fundamentals 2 course when that occurs. So the thing about the golden mean or the divine proportion is that it's at the basis of all living things. There, in our human bodies, the Egyptians knew this, by the way. When you go to, and there are many books written about this. In fact, the first book that I came across, I was probably about 26 years old, 25 years old, when I came across Peter Tompkins' book, The Secret of the Great Pyramids. Big, thick book. I mean, a huge book, a tome. But in it, the fact of the matter is that these pyramids, that the Great Pyramid, the mathematics were so exact, so precise. I mean, we're talking to the hundredth, thousandth of a decimal place. And it turns out that if you take a measuring from the tip of the top of the pyramid down the middle of one of the sides, not to the corner, but to the middle of one of the sides, in geometry, the line from an apex, the point of a pyramid, to the middle of a side, that line is called the apothem, A-P-O-T-H-E-M, the apothem. The apothem of the Great Pyramid divided by the distance to the corner along the base turns out to be exactly 1.618.0339. That when you look at Luxor and all of these magnificently huge temples that the Egyptians created, they are all built inherently to the golden mean proportion, because there's something about it that is the proportion upon which humans are created. And it was Da Vinci and Albrecht Dürer who basically together redefined portraits by, and the Mona Lisa, by understanding that the human eye, that the width to the height is not 1 to 2 or 2 to 3, or it's basically the golden mean. It's like 5 to 8 or 8 to 13, or how, depending upon how precise you want, to get. That the various perfect, beautiful dimensions in a human being. Yeah, you look at Albrecht Dürer's portraits of Christ. Every little thing in it is a ratio of that 1.62 or that 1.618 or 1.339, the width of the nose to the height of the nose, the width of the mouth to the height. And it turns out that even in the human body, the measurement in a quote unquote perfect human from the elbow to the, the shoulder to the elbow, divided by the elbow to the wrist, divided by the wrist to the first knuckle, the knuckle to the neck, these are all basically based upon the divine proportion, sacred geometry. And now we come full swing back to the Masons, because the one thing that all the ancient cathedrals have in common is that every cathedral, no matter how large it is, no matter how small it is, that the proportions of the rooms in the cathedrals are all made to what are called, now they might be called the golden squares, because that we call it the golden mean rather than the divine proportion. And what that means is that one side of the square, I mean, if you look at the chat box we're in and your picture or my picture, there is a short side and a long side to that box, that rectangle that we're in. If you make the short side one, in a golden rectangle, the long side would be 1.61803. All the great cathedrals have the great rooms at that proportion. And the anterooms off of it have the side that's the height on the chat box that we're in, or that where our portraits are in right now. If you make that short side, originally I said that's one and the long side is 1.6. Let's just say 1.6, it's close enough for now. If you made the short side 1.6, then there is another box that we could make that would have that would have 1 to 1.6 that would come off each side. So you could make ratios of the same thing that would go from vertical to horizontal to vertical to horizontal as they got larger or smaller, but in the same proportion. So the anteroom off the great room still is built to the great, still built to the exact same proportion of the golden mean or the divine proportion. And here's where it gets crazy. So are the windows, so are the doors, that as you go into these temples and measure them, part of why they feel resonant and magical, regardless of what religion you may be tied to, there's something that says, holy smokes, there's something amazing about this. It's because they're built to the proportion that we are built to. And you can go in the human body all the way down to the structure within the cell. Every cell, we're made up of, I don't know how many trillions, you know, 55 trillion, I don't know what the number is, trillions of cells. And inside every cell, there is a bony lattice that gives the cell structure. And when I learned biology, I learned that these fibers were actually the structure. They're like the bones of the cell. And it turns out that these fibers that are the bones of the cell are made of a protein called clarinthin. I always get it mixed up with the allergy medicine Claritin, but it's clarinthin. And the clarinthin basically in these little bony structures is a molecule that appears in rings of 5, followed by a ring of 8, followed by a ring of 5, followed by a ring of 8, followed by a ring of five. Five and eight are Fibonacci numbers, the cellular mathematical construction of the fibers that create the structures in our body are based upon Fibonacci numbers. Five and eight define the spiral on a pine cone. Sunflower seeds, I've done this. You can go to the center of a sunflower seed and you see the spiral and you count out the seeds one way. And then you count starting from the same point in the other direction and you divide one by the other and you get 1.6. It's a natural curve of beauty that actually defines the curves of a woman. Ah, the curves of a quote unquote ideal woman, whatever that means. And I don't mean a photoshopped woman, basically conforms to this golden mean or divine proportion. And here's where we now take the leap, because Da Vinci and his cohorts basically questioned, is there something inherently beautiful in the universe, or is beauty a judgment of humans that we make about what's beautiful? And they, through analysis and discovery, decided that regardless of what our cultural biases or individual tastes might be, that there is something, in fact, that is the basis of beauty in the universe. And it's the divine proportion, the 1.62. That is the ratio of beauty. And in fact, Da Vinci illustrated an entire book on the aesthetics of beauty, on the mathematics of the divine. He called it the divine proportion. We would moderners would call it the golden mean. And we use the Greek letter phi, not pi, but it looks like the Greek letter phi looks like a P going in both directions. You know, it looks like a P, but then reversed with the stem the same. So it's like a stem with a P in the regular direction and one backwards. And sometimes it's a circle with a line through it. And I think that's the capital version. But the letter phi in Greek is the 1.618033 ... Now, you may have caught, I said earlier, the only way to create geometrically, using sacred geometry, to create the ratio, which was now used in creating all these churches. How did you get the ratio? How did they figure out how tall to make a door when they knew how wide it was? Well, they got out their compasses and straight edges and they made a five-pointed star, because when you make a five-pointed star, the lines on the five-pointed star crisscross each other. And where they crisscross each other, they divide every line, they cut every line in three places. I might have to resort here because I'm not set up to share this on my screen, although I certainly could be, but I'm not set up to do it. But I can do this really, really quickly here. And that is, okay, there's a five-pointed star. Are you with me? Yeah. Can you see how each line on the five-pointed star is cut in two different places?
Yes.
I'm going to just take one line and put dots. There it is cut in two different places. Are you with me?
Yes.
I don't care what size the five-pointed star is, but if this is, if the point between those, let me get this right. If between those two dots, between here and here, if that's 1 inch, 1 mile, 1 cubit, I don't care what, 1 millimeter, if that's 1 unit long, then the longer side of this, which goes through the other cut, can you see that there's a longer side and a shorter side?
Yes.
If this is one, then the longer side is 1.618033 ... So every five-pointed star divides every side of it into a shorter and longer piece, which means that the shorter would be 1 unit, the longer would be 1.6 1.8033 units, 1.618033 1 to 1.62, we'll say. Now, if we said the longer piece was 1, then the entire length of the side would be 1.618033, because the shorter is to the longer as the longer is to the longest, where A plus B always equals C. In other words, when you add the shorter to the longer, you get a full side, and the ratio from the short to the longer is the same as the ratio of the longer to the whole. That the ratio is always consistent. And Johannes Kepler said that the divine proportion is the ratio that God uses to create like from like. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, we could go down that rabbit hole for a half an hour. We're not going to, because I want to hit the punchline here. And the punchline is that most astrologers know that if you're standing on the sun, which I don't recommend doing, but if you're standing there in the center here on the sun, and Venus is going around the sun, and the Earth is going around the sun, that Venus catches up to the Earth from the sun's point of view 5 times every 8 years. You recognize those numbers?
Yes.
And it does it 72 degrees away from where it did it the previous time. 72 times 5 is 360 degrees. When you have a five-pointed star, you always have the points 72 degrees apart. That the ratio of Venus to Earth creates a grand five-pointed star. You've probably had astrologers on who have talked about the Venus star. That's what we're talking about here. And now what we're talking about also is the fact that it takes Venus 222.4 days to go around the sun once. It takes Earth 365.24 days to go around the Earth once. And I don't have my calculator or my phone. Do you have a phone in front of you?
I do. Yes.
All right. Do us the magic. Find your calculator.
Okay.
Divide 365.24.
Yep.
By 222.4. In other words, we're dividing the hum of Earth by the hum of Venus.
1.64.
Well, it's actually 1.363 something. It's basically the golden mean.
1.64226619.
Well, it's within 1%.
Right.
Of the 1.62. Venus to Earth is the golden mean proportion. That's why it creates the five-pointed star. The only way to create the five-pointed star is by, I'm sorry, the only way to create geometrically, the only way to create the divine proportion is by creating a five-pointed star. And so the fact is that when you take the ratio of Venus at 224 and a half days and Earth is 365.2524. You do it the other way around, it comes out to 0.614, which is close to 0.618. Here's the other crazy thing, and then we're going to go away from this and talk more about sacred geometry as it hits astrology in a number of other ways. The number 1.618033 squared, meaning that times itself. 2 squared is 4. 2 times 2 is 4. 5 squared is 25. 5 times 5 is 25. 1.618033 times 1.618033 is 2.618033. Do that one on your, you know, it turns out that this magic ratio is the place where the adding, the multiplying, and the exponential all come together. So that if you have 1.618033 618 times 1.618. That's 2. I get 617924. I mean, it's like within a thousandths of a decimal, and we started off with a rounded number. So it's the place at where it all comes together. So now let's come back to astrology and look at Johannes Kepler, who amongst other things wrote this book called Mysterium Cosmographicum, The Mysteries of the Cosmos. And there's a picture that floats around as a woodcut that comes from his illustrations of where you have the platonic solids an icosahedron, a tetrahedron, a square, an icosahedron, and a dodecahedron, all nested one inside of another, that create the planets in relationship to each other as to how they fall out in their ratio. Now, it turns out that he wasn't exactly right, but just the idea in his brain that there would be this consistency from the sacredness of geometry to the planets, and it turns out there is, but it wasn't just that, is just fascinating. And it's fascinating that Venus, as an example, Venus is the planet of beauty. It's the planet of love. It's the planet of aesthetic perfection. And it hums its melody to Earth at a frequency that's the divine proportion to Earth. Who could make this up? And it's so built into the fabric of our culture and our civilization that it's part of the Hermetic teaching, because unless you know it, you'd have no way of ever knowing it. Now, there's something else in biology called phyllotaxis, P-H-Y-L-L-O-T-A-X-I-S, phyllotaxis. Phyllotaxis is one of the classifications that a botanist will give to any species. As they're identifying a species or whatever, they'll go, it looks like this, it looks like this, and its phyllotaxis is. And the phyllotaxis is always given as two numbers. And the two numbers in phyllotaxis is the number of occurrences on a stem as the spiral of the twigs go around. It's the number of stems that occur and versus how many times around it's gone. And phyllotaxis, it turns out, with no exceptions, are always Fibonacci numbers. In other words, that the phyllotaxis is always 3/2 or 5/3 or 8/5. There's no species with phyllotaxis of 3/2. That's a still a Fibonacci, of 4/3. They are all numbers on this magical sequence. So what we're looking at with astrology is sacred geometry, because we're looking at the geometry of triangles and squares and pentagrams and hexagrams, and some of these are star, you know, like a star hexagram is a Star of David, you know, a star, you know, a pentagram is basically, it's what we think of as a five-pointed star. But we can also create, you know, an eight-pointed star or a 12-pointed star. And these stars, based upon these geometrical figures that come from Plato's concepts of geometry, are the origins not only of aspects, because aspects are based upon this sacred geometry, but it's also the meanings themselves of the signs, because the signs themselves derive their meanings from the geometry that they create going around the circle. And so astrology turns out to be a form of sacred geometry, because sacred geometry is the mathematics of form, but how it connects to the cosmos. Remember, going back to Pythagoras, Pythagoras said the universe consists of vibration. He wrote, all is vibration. Elsewhere, he wrote, vibration always occurs in sympathy. Vibration always occurs in sympathy. No vibration arises alone. When Pythagoras and Kepler talked about the music of the spheres, they were talking about vibration. Now, if no one here has ever, I saw someone post something on one of the threads on the Astrology Hub Facebook page, and it was referring to someone who's just duplicated something that's been around forever, and they're called Chladni patterns. Did you see this post on your page? But it wasn't referred to as Chladni patterns. Chladni, I think he was a Hungarian, Chladni, basically took fine grains of sand, very fine, like talc, and put it on metal plates, and then using sound vibrated the plates and saw that the particles of talc or sand would actually form geometric patterns. And someone had a little YouTube clip that they posted on a discussion, and actually the reason why I know it's there is someone tagged and said Rick Levine would like this and put an at and tagged me. But it's not like Rick Levine would like this. Rick Levine has known about this for decades, and the real thing to do is to go to YouTube and do a YouTube search on Chladni and watch how, as you alter the music, how as you alter the pitch, the patterns of the dust, of the dirt, of the molecules, of the pieces of reality on the plate actually reform. Actually, Bruce Lipton just today posted a thing, and he actually had these Chladni patterns in it because he's having a conversation with someone and they're talking about chaos. And Bruce is saying, it's chaos, but not random. And he has a picture of these Chladni patterns where you have a certain frequency and it looks like maybe it's a square with spikes in it. I mean, it's all regular geometric, like spirograph kind of patterns, you know, like these like kind of like kaleidoscope patterns. And then you turn the frequency. So it goes from and it's at a new frequency, and all of the patterns at first kind of just jumble and go into muck, and then they begin to reform in a new place. And his point was that we as a culture, as a civilization, are basically between two Chladni patterns, and that what seems to be chaos is chaos, but it's not random. It's basically the necessary chaos as you go from one pattern to a higher form or to another frequency pattern. So that's sacred geometry. You probably could YouTube, do a search on Bruce Lipton and see his current thing, or just look at some of these. There's many Chladni pattern things. They're fascinating because Chladni was the first person to demonstrate that created a whole branch of sound analysis, but he was the first person to show that there was a connection between frequency and form. Now, again, we had proportion, and we had shape, and we had, what was our third thing?
Pattern.
So the pattern changes as the frequency changes, but we don't normally think of a relationship between frequency and physicalness. And yet this is what sacred geometry is. And I want to end my little 5-minute rant by mentioning this guy who I've mentioned before, but I think I've mentioned another one of his books. Arthur Young he's the patent holder on the Bell helicopter. So this guy was an engineer. I mean, he was like a famous engineer because he invented the helicopter. He was also an astrologer. He never wore that really, big in his professional world. But he wrote 3 books that I know of. They're all very interesting. This book called The Reflexive Universe, the subtitle is Evolution of Consciousness. But his other book, his first book, the one that came before this, is called The Geometry of Meaning. And these two books together, The Geometry of Meaning and The Evolution of Consciousness, it's all about mathematics and patterns and patterning. I mean, I just opened to a random page here, you know, and we're looking at patterns. I turn the page to the next page. And here again, we're looking at, you know, at patterns, you know, and the reflexive universe and the mathematics of meaning are books that are about sacred geometry. Again, and there's a wonderful book that's called the Geometry of the Universe, the Elements of Geometry. I'll think of the name of it in a moment. It's by Michael Schneider. And if you ask me a question, that'll give me enough time to Google. I don't know why I can't remember the name.
I know, but my questions will all require very long responses, I'm sure.
No, S-C-A.
I feel like we need a part two, because I don't even think I can ask the questions.
A Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe, a Mathematical Archetype of the Mathematical Archetypes of Nature and Science. This book by Michael Schneider, A Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe. It's not an astrology book, but you look at that book and you read it. There's a set of six or eight workbooks that are separate, and it'll change how you think of the relationship between the patterns and the movements. Because when we're looking at a chart, what we're looking at are patterns. We're looking at geometry. We're looking at, and I think I said this in the foundations course, that in geometry, when you draw a line inside of a circle, that line is by definition called a chord. And that's all aspects are. When you take any two planets and you connect them, you create a chord. It's geometry, except it's not just removed geometry of numbers. The sacred part of the geometry is Arthur Young's title of his book, The Geometry of Meaning. It's about all numbers, all shapes, all patterns, all frequencies are interrelated and have meaning, and astrology is one way of getting at that sacred geometry. I would say that pure numerology is also, because even though numerology is conceptually in the realm of numbers, the book Constructing the Universe, there's a difference between making a construction based upon 2, 3, 5, 7, or 8. And so the numbers themselves have inherent conceptual meaning that's dynamic, that is based upon the geometry. How'd we do?
Oh my God. Wow. You guys, you have to hear the backstory of how this even comes up. So I make a list of fun, cool topics we could talk about before we go live. It's like, I read the list and today I looked at sacred geometry. I was like, do you want to talk about sacred geometry? And he's like, sure.
Actually, at first I said, all right.
All right.
And the reason why I hesitated was there are two or three books that I would have loved to have had in front of me to either read something that led me in the direction there. And maybe next time round, maybe we can revisit that, because there are some books on sacred. There's many books on sacred geometry, and astrology is simply one mapping of the sacredness of geometry. You know, when the ancients built something, when we build things, we just build it, you know. Yes. But when the ancients build something, everything they created was sacred.
Yes. Yes. You know, I'm looking up something from Tesla.
The quote is, if you want to find the secret of the universe, think in terms of energy, frequency, and vibration.
Yes, that one. And then something about understanding 3.
Yeah, actually 369. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, that's interesting too. But I mean, if I had to boil down everything you just said,
I'm going to go do drugs while you boil.
No, I'm not even going to do that. I'm going to say this is my, who cares? So what does it all mean? You basically said there's an underlying mathematical pattern or number that that
to
animates
to everything.
In everything in all life, in us, in nature, in the planet. And that is also what we consider beauty. It actually is beauty.
That is the beauty in cosmos.
Exactly.
We've talked about this before, that to the Greeks, the word cosmo meant order and beauty. The
right.
two had to be present for it to be cosmic.
Right. And we're when things feel good, look good to us aesthetically, they have this underlying, these Fibonacci numbers at their core. There are secret societies and ancient civilizations who have known this forever. It appears to be the architecture that God uses to create life, whatever God is, to create life. And we're a part of it, and it's reflected outside of us. And we use it in astrology as we look at aspects. There's planets that move it, like Venus moves in the five-pointed star. I mean, the movements, the patterns, all of it is reflecting this sacred geometry.
Yeah,
when
you flush a toilet, it's the golden mean proportion that defines the shape of the spiral.
It's unbelievable. I mean, it really is unbelievable. And so, I mean, I have questions about, like, you know, wait, you said we just throw things up. I was wondering about, like, the geometry of, like, a virus, for example. Would it be, like you said, the flower is poisonous when it has six petals. So yes. Does a virus, for example,
it turns out, when they were discovered, was a bit of a mind-blowing thing, because there's a similar story to the discovery of the structure of viruses and the discovery of a breakthrough that occurred in the 1970s, and that was the discovery of a new form of carbon, which was called carbon-60. You know, carbon is either like in graphite, there's six carbon molecules that form a chain. And then they discovered, by shooting pulverized microscopic carbon into a laser, they could create a form of carbon that was one molecule of carbon with 60 atoms of carbon in it, creating what looked like the shape of a soccer ball. And the guy who discovered this, who I think was awarded a Nobel Prize, a guy named, I think his name was Richard Smalley from the University of Arizona, he wrote a paper on it, because it was a major discovery, and he named it saccharine, was the chemical, and it was named saccharine because it looked like the pattern of hexagons and pentagons that are on a soccer ball, you know, the black and white shape, you know, the shape of a soccer ball. It's round, but the pattern on all soccer balls are the same. Mm-hmm. Are you with me?
Yes, yes.
And one of his graduate students who read the paper before it published said, "I think you need to read Buckminster Fuller before you publish this, because the shape of these soccer balls is based upon the sacred geometry of Buckminster Fuller, who actually also wrote, 'The universe consists of angle and frequency.' Great line of Fuller's. The universe consists of angle and frequency." What the hell does that mean?
Wow.
We could come back to that sometime. But it turns out that the shape of this carbon-60 molecule was the shape of a Buckminster Fuller geodesic dome. And so he changed the name of it, and you can Google this. I mean, it's a huge, they're called Buckminster Fullerenes. One word, all lowercase, Buckminster Fullerenes. They refer to them as fullerenes, but it's a whole class now of molecules that have actually been discovered naturally. It's an old perfect form of carbon. It's going to give us eventually room temperature superconductivity. It's going to give us windows that turn dark, not by polarization, but like instantaneous with light against them. It's going to give us the ability to cage molecules and deliver them nanotechnologically in as medicines to different parts of the body. Buckminster fullerenes are probably one of the greatest breakthroughs that no one knows about yet. But on university levels, on campuses, this is like one of the hottest areas of research around the world. There are manufacturers already making Buckminster fullerene, but it's sacred geometry. That's where we're going with this. It's like, and the punchline is that viruses basically can form, they look like little geodesic domes. Now, Fuller did not know that when he came up with the mathematics. His breakthrough book that was mathematic was called, the name of the book is Synergetics, and it's called The Geometry of Thinking is the title of the book. Now, if that's not mind-blowing enough in itself, but viruses actually conform to the shape of Buckminster Fuller's patented geodesic domes.
Whoa. Okay, this is really mind-blowing. I feel like there's a huge rabbit hole here. Not that we haven't already been down one.
Yeah, I'd say a third of those books are me having fallen deeper and deeper into that rabbit hole over the last 40 years.
Wow. Okay. There's a lot we don't know still.
Oh, yeah. Now, one of the strangest books I ever, it's the only book I've ever stolen.
Oh my God.
Well, no, I paid $140 for it because I took it out of the library and I didn't return it. But it was a book that I couldn't get because it was published by the University of Arizona. Uh-huh. And so I paid for it. But it was a book about carbon 60, about Buckminster fullerenes. And the front cover of the book was a picture of the Great Pyramid of Giza and the spiraling arms of the Milky Way galaxy. You see, because the fullerenes conform to the golden mean, you know, ratio. And so it was like, wait a minute, this whole book is a non-compute. Why are these engineers writing this book with pictures of pharaohs on it? Something here is not right.
Wow. Okay. Well, this opens up just a whole line of questions that I know we absolutely don't have time for, but it's almost like probably most people will want to watch this several times to get the whole thing. And then it's kind of where could this take us? It's like you keep going and it's like, there's a lot of questions.
Where it takes us astrologically, and this is something we will dig into in the second fundamentals course, foundations of astrology course, and that is it takes us into the aspects of quintiles, because quintiles are based upon the five-pointed star that modern patriarchal male-dominated astrology has largely left out, and the five-pointed star is the symbol of the feminine earth religions. Wow. So the connection there, and that'll become a module in the new course.
Whoa, fascinating. All right. You are mind blowing. How is all of that in your head? I don't understand. It's so amazing. Thank you for being the rented mouth. You're quite good at it. And thank you so much for being here. Thank you, all of you, for being here. And together we get to explore this just fascinating field that is endless.
It never ends.
Yeah. It's unbelievable. You know,
Amanda, I've said this before, but I really mean it. It's like I've been digging into this stuff seriously digging into it for 45 years, seriously. And I just feel like, my time is going to run out sooner or later. And I feel like I'm just scratching the surface. Like I'm just scratching the surface. It's like, what a waste. So thank you for this opportunity to share some of it, for real.
Gosh, it's incredible. Thank you for being willing to share, for being here with us every single week. It is such an honor. Wow. And thanks all of you for being here every week. One thing I did want to mention, I meant to mention at the very beginning, but I totally forgot, is that we are having a 2021 forecast event, December 10th and 11th. We'll be featuring 13 astrologers. Rick's not one of them, but that's only because we do so much other amazing things.
I'll be there in spirit. And 13 is a Fibonacci number.
Yes. Yes. And 13 is a number that became evil, right?
Well, because that's right, because it doesn't fit into the male, like the fivefold, you know, you think of the five pointed star with the point down. It's a symbol of satanic, you know, it's like the things that don't fit into the geometry of four, let's square up our relationship. That's great that, you know, but, you know, no one's going to ever 13 up a relationship. There's something weird about that.
So we're having this event. It's 2 days of panel discussions about 2021. So the most important transits, the themes, just the input that the astrologers have on the year ahead. And one of the things I love the most is their dynamic with each other, which is always that totally unpredictable. We'll see what happens, but it's always a lot of fun. We're shortening it. In the past, we have done like 4 days of forecasting. And by the end, everybody's exhausted. And we even called it a marathon. So this year, we're just doing the 2 days of panels. We do have the podcast series, which is the 2021 prep series, where we get to go more in depth with each astrologer. But the event, again, is December 10th and 11th. It's totally free. And you go to astrologyhub.com/2021. astrologyhub.com/2021. If you're an Inner Circle member, you do not need to register. You're already registered. And the 13 astrologers are also the Inner Circle guides for next year. So you'll get to meet the astrologers that are going to be the guides next year. What are you doing with that flower?
I'm giving it to you.
I was trying to count this one.
I'm giving it to you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. That's so sweet. I'll take it.
I just put it into the transporter beam and went zzz.
Someday, probably. All right, everybody, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for being a part of our community. And thank you, as always, for making astrology a part of your life. We'll catch you on the next episode. Hey, astrology lovers, it's that time of year. We're getting ready for our 6th annual free forecast event, featuring a panel of 13 top astrologers and focusing on what's coming our way in 2021. You'll get answers to key questions like, what are the big themes of 2021? How can you proactively work with the key transits coming next year? What's the grand conjunction? And why have astrologers been talking about it for ages? And the question that's on everybody's mind, is it over yet? Join me and these 13 amazing astrologers for this free, dynamic, and informative event, December 10th and 11th, and get the information you need to ride the waves of 2021 with grace. Go to astrologyhub.com/2021. Again, that's astrologyhub.com/2021. Can't wait to see you on the inside.